We're talking about the Latino community being hit hard by COVID. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Official statistics from the CDC show that Latinos in America are hospitalized or dying from the coronavirus at four times the rates of people who are white, and that there could be a serious undercount here. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say gaps in their data come from their dependence on local reporting from the states. Are infection rates in your community soaring? Why is that? Where do you get your information about COVID-19? We're at 800-642-1234. Dr. Zeno Franco is an associate professor of family and community medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Dr. Franco, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
Can you give us some perspective, some overview, if you will, what the Latino community in Wisconsin is facing right now?
Sure. I'm a Hispanic professor at the medical college, and so this issue is near and dear to my heart. I think, you know, one of the issues for us is that, initially the spread was largely in the African-American community. The deaths were largely in the African-American community. And then things started to spread out into the white community as well. But I think a little bit of complacency set in, I think, early on, where people felt like they weren't going to get impacted because it was just in one region. And that's not the case. The virus doesn't discriminate. It will affect anybody. And so I think what we're seeing now is that it's actually moving from community to community, and Hispanics are just as vulnerable as any other group. And there's actually some specific issues within each of the communities of color that we work with that have created some additional vulnerability and some issues there. So we are very concerned at the moment.
What do you see in Milwaukee County, which leads the number of cases?
Yeah, I think, you know, when we're looking at the South Side right now, as you mentioned, there's a hotspot in the Hispanic community. We know and have worked with a number of folks across the entire city who've been impacted. And so the deaths and the impact have been very real for us at the medical college. So, you know, we're worried about folks not taking it seriously enough. And there are also a number of essential workers on the South Side who do need to go to work to keep a paycheck coming and to keep their families sustained. And that essential work is something that puts them at risk. It puts them in a vulnerable situation. Of course, because of the mixed documentation status in many of the homes, there are concerns about disclosure as well. So folks don't want to necessarily talk about what their COVID-19 status is. They may not want to disclose to their employer because they're afraid of what the ramifications may be.
Okay, so you bring up a lot of issues there. One about vulnerability of workers who are working these essential jobs, interfacing with a lot more of the public, but then being very, very hesitant about sharing their status of a test. What is going on there?
Yeah, I think, you know, for any of us, being ill is, you know, you worry about how people are going to perceive that. In this situation, it's a very serious illness. For some people, it's, you know, obviously it has a lot of community level implications. And so people from all backgrounds, I think, are a little bit less happy to talk about kind of what their status is in terms of COVID-19. I think that's only magnified when you think about the Hispanic population, again, the undocumented status, being worried about being able to bring in a paycheck. If a production plant goes down because there's a number of people that are sick, that's going to impact a whole bunch of people as well. And so I think because of, you know, just this sort of normal stigma about being ill, people may not want to reveal that information, but you have this kind of overlay with the documentation status. And I think one of the things that we're really trying to get information out to people is that the testing doesn't have anything to do with your status as a citizen here or as a non-citizen. We're not looking to deport anybody. We're looking to make sure that people get tested so that we know whether they're healthy or not, whether they can return to work, and so that we can get them information and support if they need to isolate. That's the key, is really making sure that people are communicating what their status is, getting tested if they need to be tested, and trying to help the entire community stem this problem.
If you're just joining us, we're asking about how the coronavirus is affecting the Latino community, in particular with Dr. Zeno Franco, who is an associate professor of family and community medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin. You can join in. Are you an immigrant, or do you work with people who are from other countries? Did you have a discussion about wearing a mask at work or taking safety precautions because of the virus? What resources do you provide? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Franco, in terms of access to health care and the, you know, contributions of the rates of diabetes, other conditions, how can that complicate the situation around this pandemic?
Yeah, I think that's one of the biggest issues for us right now is that there is differential impact based on health status. If you have a chronic condition, that makes you a lot more vulnerable, as we all know. But I think one of the things that we saw very early on in the epidemic here in Milwaukee is communities of color have higher rates of these chronic long-term health conditions. For whatever reason, maybe just because there was a person who had it early on that was African-American, the African-American community started to see really widespread infection rates and deaths associated with this very early in the process. And I think we started to get very focused on sort of that. And I think what that really shows is that there are fundamental differences in this community in terms of access to healthcare, in terms of rates of these long-term chronic diseases that haven't been well controlled in the past. And so all of a sudden, the systemic problems that we have that we haven't resolved as a society come up in full force. And so this is really, I think, a point in time where we need to reconceptualize how we think about the city of Milwaukee for the health of all. And so in a funny sense, we've been able to kind of let this play out under the radar. We know it's there in terms of the discrimination and the segregation in the city. This is one of the most segregated cities in the country. But COVID-19 laid that bare. And so we had the early deaths in the African-American community. Devastating for a number of people that I work with personally. I have a lot of strong connections with folks that I've worked with in the African American community over the last decade. And those were very personal losses for folks. And what we're really concerned about right now is that the same thing is going to start to happen on the South Side. The rates of death haven't been as high, but we think that some of that is trailing the infection rate. So You're exactly right that these sort of underlying chronic conditions make people vulnerable. Those are disproportionately represented in our minority communities, and it's a very real concern.
The pandemic is exposing inequities, and it sounds like where you're talking, the public health is trying to get in front of something that has been a problem for so long.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is one of those situations where we're kind of caught, because we haven't taken care of this as a society earlier on. This particular situation is kind of getting ahead of us in that way. And so we're trying to rally as many resources right now as we can to try to address it.
Dr. Zeno Franco, Center for Healthy Communities and Research at the Medical College of Wisconsin. You can join in. We're talking about healthcare challenges facing Latinos during the pandemic. What do you find in your community? What is the impact? Do you see infection rates higher in your neighborhood? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Dr. Franco here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Latinos may be more vulnerable to the virus as a result of the same factors that have put communities of color at risk nationwide. As we've learned, holding down an essential service job requires interacting with the public during the pandemic. We've also been learning how a lack of access to healthcare contributes to vulnerabilities with the spread of the virus. How do you think we should address the racial disparities in coronavirus infections? Did a contact tracer or clinician inquire about your ethnicity and background when you learned of your test results or received hospital treatment? Join in 800-642-1234. We have Dr. Zeno Franco, who is with the Medical College of Wisconsin. He stays with us. Dr. Franco, CDC is saying there are gaps in its data reporting. It's reliant on what the states tell the CDC about infection rates. Why is inaccurate data problematic in a pandemic, especially in the Latino community?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things is information is power in these situations. And the more accurate information that we have, the better we can sort of see where a hotspot is occurring and respond to it effectively. So, you know, time and again, we see that sort of the reliance on high quality data is what makes a big difference in these events.
Federal and local governments and hospitals, they may all count race and ethnicity differently. And even on forms like the census, the government race category doesn't have a box to check for Latinos. How can this lack of specificity, you know, be problematic for public health?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things with that is that the more detailed information that we have about a person's background, the more that we're able to start to understand. And I think one of the things is we have to not just think about this pandemic. Another pandemic is possible. We don't really want to think about that, but I think it's super important. I think this has really raised awareness in people that we need to be spending more time and more effort and frankly, more money on public health and basic research that can assist us. The more detailed picture that we have about a person's background, the more we can understand how the disease has impacted them. If we do have deaths in minority communities, why is that occurring? Why is that disproportion there? And so, again, tracking back to what we were talking about, this, you know, kind of underlying health issues, there may also be genetic components that predispose certain groups of people to certain types of pathogens. And so it's really incumbent on us, I think, at this point in time to start looking at how do we engage in understanding our differences, not to separate us, but to help us really do a deeper dive on the research side that's going to help save lives in the future.
Do you find language and cultural barriers here during the pandemic? Is it important to have this information about the spread in other languages?
Yeah, and that's one of the things that we've been working on very extensively at the medical college, and other academic partners in the community are also working in the same space. So there have been a number of funded projects from the Advancing a Healthier Wisconsin Endowment. I'm actually working on one currently with the city and the county. That's taking public health information that's kind of readily available and trying to either translate that into Spanish or, in a sense, transliterate that into other cultures for communities of color that may not have as immediate access to public health information. There's a number of folks from different, you know, kind of, if you want to think about it, some older folks in some of the communities of color, even some of the younger folks, for different reasons, they may not be engaging with the public health messaging that we're seeing coming out of standard channels. And so that cultural tailoring is super important to get the word out as far as we can into the community so that people see the value of thinking about the health behaviors, wearing a mask, washing your hands, social distancing, and breaking through some of the barriers to doing some of these things. You know, a lot of the public health messaging around, say, for example, if you do need to quarantine because you have a positive case in your home, it assumes a sort of middle-class home with two bathrooms and there's one family. In reality, in the communities of color that we work with, people may be doubled or tripled up in a home, and it may be a lot more difficult to kind of quarantine one person who's sick. And so we have to really think about the assumptions that we have when we communicate about public health as well.
If you're just joining us, we're asking about how the coronavirus is affecting the Latino community in particular with Dr. Zeno Franco. He's an associate professor of family and community medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Dr. Franco, in terms of contact tracing, how well are contact tracing efforts keeping up with the demands for the numbers of Latinos who have become infected with the coronavirus and how that contact tracing works in the Latino community.
Yeah, and I don't know all the details there. I'm actually in partnership with the city and the city Department of Public Health, and there's some folks there that probably can answer this better than I can. But I think, you know, we're one of the issues for us is that we're kind of having to ramp up contact tracing. There really wasn't sort of the infrastructure built in at first. You also have to think, of course, about you need to have multilingual contact tracers. And I think one of the big things, like we've been touching on before, is trust. Folks may be a little bit reluctant to talk. They don't necessarily want to divulge who all they have been in contact with because they don't want to put other people at risk from their perspective that, you know, they could see that maybe somebody, again, has mixed documentation status in the home, and there's real concerns about privacy. And that's where this worry about, you know, being sent to country of origin is getting in the way, I think, of our public health outreach.
When you talk with your colleagues at the Medical College of Wisconsin, and you've said personally that you've seen the loss all around you, how do you talk about that loss? Because you're seeing it firsthand, and this is hitting home.
Yeah, I mean, I work with one of the most diverse staffs on campus at the medical college with a program called All of Us. And, you know, it's been very personal. We've had family members of staff who have been lost in this. And I think, you know, one of the tough things is just when people kind of try to say, well, it's not a big deal. It's a huge deal. And again, it you know, at the beginning of this, it really was impacting certain communities of color. Differentially, there was a lot of worry, a lot of concern. That's a situation, too, where conspiracy theories can sort of spin out of control that this is somehow targeted or that there's not enough services that are coming out to help deal with this. And again, like I said, the virus doesn't care what color you are, what your background is. It's going to attack whoever it can. But because of, again, these underlying health problems, because people didn't have the word initially about how important social distancing was, maybe because they weren't engaging with standard channels of communication, what we saw is, again, this differential impact in communities of color. We're having staff walk in the door telling us that they had family members that were very close to them who had passed or who were gravely ill for many days in the hospital. And that's a personal cost. It's not an abstract thing.
You and the public health community can't undo generations of racism and oppression. But what steps can we take today to help improve the outlook here on this pandemic, especially in communities of color?
Yeah, I think there's a couple things. One of the most important things, I think, from our perspective is masks and mask wearing and changing the culture around that. You know, from my perspective, in the Hispanic community, there's a real sense that we need to stay at work. We need to be protecting our families by bringing in a paycheck. And there's a certain amount of fearlessness that comes in into play with that. You can't really afford to be afraid in a sense. And so I think it's easy to say, well, I'm strong enough, I'm brave enough, I don't need a mask. This is a situation where I think in the Hispanic community, we need to not think about so much that kind of, in a sense, a bravado that comes with having to struggle to make it, and really think about what does the community need. And we also have very deep community values. We're oriented to family, we're oriented to the broader community. And remembering that the mask is not just protecting you, it's protecting everyone around you. There's sometimes what we describe as fatalism too, that, you know, if folks come from a more religious background, that it, you know, whatever happens is God's will. And that's a very deep, I think, sentiment in a lot of Hispanic culture. And I think that's fine, but this is a situation where we actually can take some actions to help, again, ourselves and each other, still being respectful of kind of the cultural values, but really kind of tapping into the communal spirit within the Hispanic culture. Mexican Fiesta has actually offered to host production and distribution of disposable masks. And we're right now we're looking for volunteers to come down to Mexican Fiesta and assist in a careful way, in a hygienic way, with producing these disposable masks that can go out to businesses, individuals in the community, different community organizations that are trying to get these out to the community. And I think the masks are ultimately going to be one of the huge factors in keeping business open for the next few months as we try to figure out how to deal with the pandemic more. So that's one thing. I think another thing is, you know, for people to get more involved in kind of thinking through, you know, what we can do in the future. There's a program that a number of the universities in the region, the Medical College, UW-Madison are involved in, called All of Us. And one of the things that that's doing right now is trying to think about the interaction between the host and the pathogen in COVID-19. And so get involved in research. Be more active in thinking through how you're interacting with the healthcare system and with health.
Dr. Franco,
for all of us.
Dr. Franco, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Dr. Zeno Franco, Associate Professor of Family and Community Medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin. We'll be back after this news update on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Native American tribes have been hit with a 1-2 punch, the opioid epidemic and the coronavirus pandemic. Tribal nations are struggling with a high rate of overdose coupled with the COVID-19 pandemic, and addressing these crises is costly. And the economic devastation from COVID has shut down hundreds of tribally owned casinos, wreaking havoc on tribal budgets. Are you a member of a tribal nation? Did your tribe receive rapid testing from Indian Health Service? Are there enough tests to go around? We're at 800-642-1234. Tehasi Hill is chairman of the Oneida Nation. Chairman Hill, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. I'm glad I could be here today.
Well, take us to the Oneida Nation Reservation, which is within Brown County, which has been a hotspot for the coronavirus. How are you addressing COVID-19 in the Oneida Nation?
Well, I think first and foremost, we're paying close attention as this was starting to break the news in the early part of the year. And as far as back as, you know, January, we were already starting to contemplate shutting down some of our larger meetings that we were planned to have in March and end up taking that action to cancel those general tribal council meetings where regularly we get between 1,500 and 1,800 tribal members in a pretty confined space to hold a meeting. And so we had taken that those actions early on to cancel those because of the spread of the coronavirus, and you know, and we've also been heeding the advice of our public health officials, CDC and WEDC, for making sure that businesses and programs and services that are open are making sure that we're doing that as safely as possible.
What have you seen with the spread, with the number of cases in the Oneida Nation?
Well, I guess generally overall our numbers, we have about 55 positive cases as of yesterday. We had two deaths about a month ago now, an older gentleman and a younger woman. And currently we have about 4 or 5 individuals currently in isolation.
How is the Oneida Community Health Services Department responding to the situation?
They also responded, you know, quite well, and had recommendations put forth right away that our business committee had considered and took up. And so they had kind of immediately put a halt to kind of regularly scheduled doctor's appointments, you know, annual physicals and well child checkups and things like that. To make sure that the healthy people weren't coming in and being in close proximity to people who could potentially have the virus.
From what I understand, the United Nations is still under a state of emergency declaration and a safer at home order extending until August 11th. Is that right?
Yes, that is right. We just last week kind of reauthorized another 30 days of the public health emergency, and that's a part of our Homeland Security emergency management law that we have in place here at Oneida that authorizes for 30-day increments. And so looking at the advice from our health officials, they're saying that since March that this definitely is going to be somewhere into 3 to 6 months of trying to deal with this pandemic, kind of initially, I guess, for the first wave. And so it's likely we'll be continuing to have a public health emergency in 30-day increments until either until a vaccine is developed and that's safe for everyone to be to utilize, or until it starts going away when people start heeding the advice of the CDC and public health officials to mask and stay home and social distance.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Tehasi Hill. He's chairman of the United Nation. We're looking at how the pandemic is affecting his community. And you can join in. Are you a member of a tribal community here in Wisconsin? How have you proceeded during this pandemic? Are you under an emergency and doing a safer at home order? Join in at 800-642-1234. Chairman Hill, this morning in preparation, I was watching your State of the Tribes address from last year and thinking about how difficult it must be, because at that time you were telling lawmakers that the opioid epidemic was the central destructive force that was really hitting tribal communities. How are you looking at the epidemic now in the face of COVID?
Yeah, things have been changing, you know, quite a bit, and in consultation with our health officials as well, they're kind of changing how treatment and counseling are taking place, obviously with trying to reduce the amount of, you know, face-to-face close contacts. A lot of the treatments and consult have been over the phone, telehealth
yeah,
or video conferencing in to still try to meet the needs of our community, especially when it comes to mental health.
What is unemployment like right now?
Currently, we're still sitting for Oneida Nation's employment level itself at about 50%.
And what does that mean, you know, sitting at 50%? How is that affecting families?
Yeah, it definitely is. We've taken action to try to mitigate those negative aspects of being, you know, furloughed or laid off. So through our tribal housing programs, we've authorized for kind of a forgiveness for rents and mortgages to make sure that families can stay in their homes and put a halt to any foreclosures also during this time. So, and also utility, our water and sewer utility bills have also been at this point still forgiven at this point. So we're trying to, like I said, reduce those costs to our membership to make sure that they can stay in their homes and that they have continued access to, you know, safe water and sewer.
What is the timeline for those actions? I mean, you must be looking out in the distance and saying, how can we afford to do this and for how many months?
Yeah, exactly. And that's, you know, what we're currently dealing with, obviously, with our main revenue driver, gaming, being shut down for a couple of months and then having a slow, steady start. Our revenues aren't where, obviously, they're projected to be for this time of year. And so that is kind of the quandary that we're trying to deal with on a daily basis, is figuring out how to work all this programs and services and keeping our community safe. And in doing so, it's really kind of compounded as well by the CARES Act and other federal funding that, you know, specific language in the in those bills that are those laws that do not allow for certain activities. So for like the CARES Act, we can't use that money for anything that we had budgeted for. So if we had budgeted programs and services for utility assistance or, you know, whatever it might have been, we cannot use that CARES money for that particular program. So, you know,
what has been the role of the federal government aid as you see it to date?
Well, I guess so far for this pandemic, you know, I can definitely say really good things about the Indian Health Service, IHS. They have been very willing to meet and have teleconferences regularly, weekly teleconferences, and to get our communities testing supplies and PPE on a regular basis, and so they've really been stepped up to the plate to uphold, you know, their end of the federal government's responsibility to, you know, Native tribes across the country.
How can you use the stimulus aid then from the CARES Act?
Well, primarily we're currently just reimbursing for a lot of the additional costs due to COVID. So, you know, specific cleaning supplies that are obviously antiviral, and then things that we had put in place for our retail enterprises and gaming enterprises for the plexiglass barriers for the cashiers and the workers in retail, and then to kind of create a shroud, I guess, around the slot machines and at the tables as well. So we've Oneida Nation has spent about, you know, $500,000 on safety equipment and supplies.
Are you worried that some of your programs, where the dollars aren't flowing into these programs, that you're going to either have to do layoffs or disband programs?
Yeah, that's pretty much what we are currently going through right now with our current revenue projections, and seeing where that puts us by the end of, you know, the next fiscal year. Right now we run on a fiscal year that ends on or begins October 1, so we only have a couple of months left of this fiscal year to day by day, and then for the next fiscal year, looking at those revenue projections and the costs of employment and programs and services, figuring out where we land at the end of next year to really try to figure out if more cuts are needed.
We're talking with Oneida Nation Chairman Tehasi Hill and the work of First Nations to provide services amid the pandemic as revenue streams, as we've been hearing, from gaming operations dry up. Are you a member of a tribal nation? Do you work at a tribal-owned casino? Are you out of work? Is the casino open with precautions in place? How is your health and the health of your community? Join in with your questions, your insights, 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute with the Oneida Nation Chairman right here on the Ideas Network. We have the chairman of the Oneida Nation, Tehasi Hill, here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Indian Health Service, or IHS, has distributed around $31 million to our state's 11 tribes as part of $1 billion awarded to the federal agency under the federal coronavirus aid response. Tribal health advocates want lawmakers to provide more funding for IHS to help tribes with the coronavirus response in its next relief package. How is your tribal government navigating the impact of COVID? What vital services are running short on funding? And where is help needed the most? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. And Chairman Hill stays with us. Chairman, the National Indian Gaming Association recently said that gaming is what the tribes largely survive on, and that in a lot of cases, quote, if we don't have gaming, we don't have dollars. How has the pandemic impacted this for the Oneida Nation?
Yeah, definitely. That's definitely the case for Oneida and many, the vast majority of, I think, the tribal nations across the country. And I think it's kind of like similar to, you know, everyday life of living paycheck to paycheck. So, you know, every week gaming facilities deposit money into the bank account on Sunday or Monday, whatever it might, the specific day might be. And then that money is quickly doled out in payroll and in other expenses, you know, later that week or the next week. So it is, most tribes were put in a pretty precarious position once those dollars stopped flowing in. And I guess for at Oneida, I guess we were fortunate to have a relatively small, you know, amount of reserves saved for in case of a rainy day, but definitely not enough to fund our programs and services and employment for an entire year or anything like that. And I think that's ultimately what the a new goal is going to be.
What is the status of your gaming operations?
So currently we opened up in two phases. So about a month ago, 5 or so weeks, we opened up phase one, which just allowed about 40%, I believe, of the slot machines, 40, 50% of the slot machines. So to allow for social distancing on the gaming floor, essentially it was every other machine was essentially roped off so and rendered inoperable so that people couldn't have the opportunity to sit, you know, side by side, you know, within a foot or two of each other. So that definitely has been, I guess, the main thing that is slow to allow revenue come back.
What precautions are you taking with employees at these facilities?
Yep, so precautions at the facilities is masks are required for both employees and patrons, and we installed plexiglass for protective barriers, and sanitizing is done, you know, around the clock. Currently, our operations, I believe, shut down from 4 a.m. till 8 a.m. for a deep cleaning. But we also have, obviously, custodians roving, you know, throughout the business hours, wiping machines down and taking care of that sanitization.
Even with limited capacity, have you seen patrons return?
Yes, yes. Patrons, you know, have returned. And I think the hopeful thing for us is that the numbers are a little bit better than we anticipated. So that I think we're on the right path, and as long as we can continue to provide a safe environment for people to get that entertainment that they're seeking, that we hope that we continue to have patrons visit us.
Last week, our show Central Time talked with Ernie Stevens III, another member of the Oneida Nation, about the tribe's experiment with hemp production. Are you looking at alternative sources of revenue like hemp production?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's something that's been, you know, on the table for a while. I've been a strong supporter of kind of diversifying the tribe's revenue streams, and I think agriculture has always been one of the areas that I continue to focus on, and in particular, I guess, industrial hemp could be a good product and food source, and it has, you know, thousands of uses. So, you know, anything we can do in a small bit or a large bite, I think, is important to make sure that our finances are in order.
Yeah. How long are you, you know, into this journey of finding whether this could be a reliable revenue stream?
Well, last year was our first growing season with it. And so that was a lot of, I guess, R&D into last year, trying a couple different different seeds and planting locations, and also, I guess, the maintenance of it. You know, is it a row crop or is it best for a greenhouse? You know, things like that. So, and last year wasn't a very good growing year to begin with for any of the agricultural products. So that was kind of hopefully being a blip on the radar of continuing to do the research and development.
We're talking with Tehasi Hill. He's chairman of the Oneida Nation. We're looking at how the pandemic is affecting tribal communities and with your questions as well, 800-642-1234. Chairman Hill, I want to turn to the Supreme Court in Oklahoma for a moment. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled this last week that much of the eastern half of Oklahoma falls within Native American territory. It's been called a very important ruling. What does this decision mean?
Yes, I think it also has ramifications right here in Wisconsin as well and through different tribes throughout the country. Sometimes municipalities or cities or villages or even states have argued that tribal reservations were disestablished or abolished by the Allotment Act. And this is clearly not the case. Both federal court systems and the Supreme Courts over the years have really made that distinction that they have not, and yet we still have to face these types of lawsuits again and again. And so hopefully with this last Supreme Court ruling that that hopefully that fight has finally been put to bed so that we can continue moving forward and trying to build better relationships between our within our states and within our communities.
How is the status, the strength of tribal sovereignty honored here in Wisconsin?
Well, I think there's always room for improvement, but I think under the current Governor Evers administration, he's really been there for the tribes to have regular consultation with and meetings with. I think that's been very helpful, especially going through this public health pandemic, making sure that his secretaries are available to answer questions or, you know, provide input as we try to navigate this new time.
In our last minute we have together, I'm wondering in this time of such uncertainty, where do you personally find hope?
Well, I really find hope in that, you know, our families and our communities are really, you know, sticking together and trying to keep each other safe and following those precautions. And for us, I think that's definitely a shining part of this pandemic is how our community has responded and been respectful of the recommendations for public health and safety, you know, masking, staying safer at home and washing your hands and making sure that your loved ones are safe.
You feel like the community has really heeded those public health precautions and taken them to heart.
Yeah, I definitely do. I think as part of the Oneida Reservation, you know, straddles, I guess, Brown and Outagamie counties, you know, with Brown County being one of the hottest spots in the state and arguably the country that for a time there that our cases being what they are at sitting at about 55, I think, is a testament to that.
Chairman Hill, thank you for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. So glad to be here.
Tehasi Hill is chairman of the Oneida Nation. Just ahead, the pandemic hasn't stopped all summer camps from operating. We learn how they're doing it and how schools could take a page out of their book in the fall. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.